Chapter 6. Kinshasa. Good case officering requires intense concentration. As the semi-literate sergeant told us in Marine Corps Basic School, proper prior preparation prevents piss-poor performance, sir. Prior mental preparation minimizes the case officer's risks. I spent the 15-hour flight from Kennedy International to Najili Airport at Kinshasa doing mental exercises in my conversational French. I hadn't been in a French-speaking country for 5 years, and it wouldn't do to go up against Roberto fumbling for words like a tourist with a phrase book. I then set my mind on Kinshasa and Angola, and tried to relive every experience I'd had in both, seeing the people again, remembering names, incidents, walking through airports, restaurants, offices, judo clubs. This mission was important, and I knew it could easily attract the attention of the Soviets, Cubans, Chinese, North Koreans, or French, although none of them would be likely to do anything dramatic to obstruct it. The press was an obvious liability. Footnote. Actually, at least in more routine operations, case officers most fear the U.S. ambassador and his staff, then restrictive headquarters cables, then curious, gossipy neighbors in the local community as potential threats to operations. Next would come the local police, then the press. Last of all is the KGB. In my 12 years of case officering, I never saw or heard of a situation in which the KGB attacked or obstructed a CIA operation. End footnote. Probably most worrisome was the knowledge that every step I took would be watched by jealous colleagues. St. Martin and some officers in Kinshasa Station would be especially critical. To them I would be a headquarters staff officer intruding in their territory. CIA lore is full of incidents which have happened to case officers while they travel the world. Case officers are subject to the same embarrassments any tourist suffers. Snarled schedules, lost passports, lost money and luggage, and getting off the plane at the wrong destination. In addition, case officers have been known to lose secret notebooks or be recognized by agents from their operational past and blow their new covers and missions. More often than one would believe, they have chatted indiscreetly with total strangers and had the conversation reported to other CIA officers. Professional reputations, if not careers, are seriously damaged by such incidents. Airports are especially hazardous to case officers. Customs and immigration officials are trained to detect the unusual. In some countries, they are especially alert to CIA officers. They can arrest, search, and detain anyone they choose under the pretext of suspected smuggling. I once watched an angry Zairean official very nearly strip and search the person of a CIA GS-17 who had forgotten to speak politely. During a 4-hour layover at Kennedy, I had briefed the communicators on our mission. They had been volunteered so abruptly, they scarcely had time to assemble the necessary gear, much less think of where we were going. Neither of them had ever been to Africa or knew much about Angola. Once in Kinshasa, they would disappear into the closed world of the Embassy Communications Center, while I was busy with St. Martin, the FNLA, and UNITA. And inside Angola, I would be immersed in my mission while they monitored the radios. In the privacy of a crowded restaurant, we had talked about Angola and then gossiped, establishing the bonds of understanding and confidence that would make us a team when we hit the field. Just before we boarded Pan Am 151, I had telephoned headquarters. Things sometimes happen quickly in the intelligence business. More than once, case officers have had their missions changed after their seatbelts were buckled. Paul Foster came on the line and we chatted for a few minutes. When we hung up, I stood reflecting on CIA telephone security. We had mentioned the FNLA, Angola, and some communications equipment that was being procured. Any intelligent person eavesdropping on the conversation would know that I was on my way to Kinshasa on an important mission relating to the war in Angola. We banked over the Congo River and the mountains descending to Najili Airport, 20 miles from Kinshasa. Landing heavily, we taxied to the nondescript white terminal. A half mile on our left were several rough-looking corrugated iron hangars, two C-130s, a DC-4, a couple of C-47s, and several single-engine planes. Mobutu's Air Force. Strewn about the grass between runways was a graveyard of stripped airframes, relics of the CIA Congo program of the 1960s. It was just after 4 p.m. local time. Inside, there would be the usual 40-minute wait for our luggage, perhaps longer considering our 16 boxes of radio equipment. My cable had made it clear we were bringing in a large quantity of gear that could not be opened by customs officials in a public air terminal. CIA procedure in such cases called for the local station to process the papers in advance of our arrival, getting help from the embassy administrative officer, and for a case officer to meet us at the airport to ensure that there were no snags. Someone was waving at us, a young man in a sports shirt, not an American. He would be the embassy's administrative assistant, a local, no doubt a displaced European, whose primary responsibility was to meet and guide all official American visitors through the pitfalls of Zairean customs. He introduced himself as Monsieur Albert, took our passports, and began processing us into the country. No one from the station was in sight, a bad sign. While waiting for Monsieur Albert to work his magic, I turned and walked to a souvenir counter and began bargaining with the sales clerk, practicing my French. Sometime later, one of the communicators called me. "Hey, John," he said, "you'd better get over here." At the baggage claim counter, it was pretty clear that things had come unstuck. We were in danger of going public on the spot. A customs officer had a firm grip on one of our boxes, tugging at the tape. The other communicator was just as firmly holding the top of the box down. They were glaring at each other. Three other customs officers were hurrying up, looking aggressive. Since the first days of independence, Zairean customs officials have struggled to assert their authority over arrogant white travelers, especially those who insist on diplomatic privilege or other special treatment. After independence, the airport was one of the first places to be Africanized, and the colonial whites, while contemptuous of the blacks' ability to officiate, were anxious. Airports were their sole link with the security of their motherlands. Whites sneered and the blacks responded with harassment and delays. In recent years, the tension had subsided. Now, Zairean officials process most passengers with little comment, but incidents still occur. Monsieur Albert was standing several feet back, obviously intimidated. The other passengers had long since cleared through the area and left. I stopped a polite yard short of the official and addressed him, citing the privileges of my diplomatic passport. He was unimpressed with protocol and snapped an order in Lingala. Two guards pounced on the boxes and disappeared into the restricted area. I followed the customs official into his office, realizing that he was in charge of the airport. At least, I insisted, he could grant me the courtesy of a call to the embassy. St. Martin eventually came on the line and wanted to talk to the customs officer. I listened in. St. Martin was pulling out all the stops, threatening to call President Mobutu himself. The customs official was still unimpressed. He hung up after St. Martin told me to wait where I was. I sat down and began to work on the customs officer and his assistant. The customs chief of Nijili Airport could be valuable when IA feature personnel and equipment began pouring into Kinshasa. His assistant was from my old province, the Kasai, and we both spoke Tshiluba fluently. They began to thaw. To the case officer, intelligence is people, not information. Recruiting agents is the name of the game. A case officer who recruits gets promoted, and good officers are always assessing people for recruitment, nearly everyone they meet. DDO studies have shown that 10% of the case officers make 90% of all recruitments, comparable to the ratio of submarine commanders in World War II who sank ships. Most case officers never recruit an agent in their careers and must accept the lesser role of maintaining operations others have created. Recruited airport officials, taxi drivers, and police officers are considered part of the plumbing of a CIA station. With little access to intelligence themselves, they facilitate the case officer's other activities. When the phone rang an hour later, we were having our second beer, the two Najili officials and I. I would probably never see them again, but talking to them, establishing rapport, as we said in the CIA, gave me confidence. After a 4-year absence from Africa, I had not lost my touch. Our beer-fueled rapport made it easy for the two officials to back down. "Mon ami," the Kazian said, "why didn't you tell us these boxes have special radio equipment for the president to use in Angola?" Our embassy limousine pulled onto the crowded highway, Monsieur Albert braking and swerving defensively around other vehicles, but plunging directly into the potholes. If Kinshasa had been spruced up and the roads repaired for the Ali Foreman fight the year before, you couldn't tell it now. Bracing the rice paper notebook on my knee, I jotted down biographical details about the customs officials. Someone from the station might follow up. The station administrative officer helped us unload our boxes in front of the embassy. I thanked Albert and was almost through the door when he called out, "Monsieur John, I think you're missing a box." He was right. There were only 15. "Welcome to Kinshasa," I muttered, continuing up the stairs. I was not a stranger here. I had worked with 4 of the regular officers in the Kinshasa station in previous assignments. The deputy chief of station, Jimmy Bartlett, had been under business cover when I was in the Ivory Coast. I had been his inside man, his only direct contact with the CIA. Another case officer, Roger Mueller, was a chess buddy from my previous headquarters tour. He was handling some of the Kinshasa station's unilateral operations. Most of Kinshasa station operations have always been bilateral, that is, declared to the Zairean Security Service, and hoped to stay out of the Angolan program. Jerry Jacobson had an elaborately backstopped cover position in the consular section that led him to avoid the station offices altogether. He had been an interim career trainee when I was chief of the Kenya-Uganda section in 1972. The clandestine services is a small, clubbish unit of 4,500 people, compartmented into geographic divisions. Africa Division itself had less than 400 staffers, and after 10 years I knew nearly all of them. Our assignments and operational travels overlapped and crisscrossed like the trails of migrating wildebeest on an East African plain. A night on the town in Paris, a 3-day course in lockpicking at headquarters, lunch in a Nairobi restaurant, all years apart, can be enough for a kind of understanding rare in other lines of work. A man I felt I understood, despite our differences, was an officer who had addressed my training class at the farm in 1965. Afterwards, he had opened up a surprisingly long way, referring to an adventure in Lubumbashi, driving about town after curfew with Patrice Lumumba's body in the trunk of his car, trying to decide what to do with it. Footnote. He presented this story in a benign light, as though he had been trying to help. It was not until 1975 that I learned the CIA had plotted Lumumba's death. End footnote. 5 years later, I found this man in an Asian post, the chief of station, sitting at a desk mounted on a platform a foot higher than the rest of the room. His chair was a tall, straight-backed Victorian antique. Behind it was a background of flags and drapes. He was glisteningly bald and stared down at me through half-closed, puffy eyes, as I tried to brief him about my mission. And in 1974, I found him again in a European station, still playing at Goldfinger in his antique chair, the same one as far as I could tell. We dined in the palatial safe house apartment, which the U.S. taxpayer maintained for him in the city. His other home was a residence 30 miles away. Twice during dinner, he went to the tiled lavatory, where he spent 15 minutes scrubbing and drying his hands, cleaning his fingernails, and staring at himself in the mirror. Such eccentricities and trademarks become part of CIA lore. The CIA's clubbishness is in a good part responsible for many of the CIA's current problems. How does one discipline a colleague who 20 years before spent sweltering nights with you in a Chinese embassy installing bugs, or who was the godfather of your children 25 years ago in Rome, or whose wife was now your wife, the exchange having taken place long ago in Bangkok? In an open, competitive environment, one might do the necessary thing, but in the closed fraternity of the CIA, it was impossible. Jerry Jacobson's cover as the ambassador's assistant was about as well protected as the agency is able to manage, as he was more fully integrated into the State Department personnel system. Nevertheless, any state employee in Washington could ascertain the truth with a simple inquiry in the right place, and at least every American in the Kinshasa embassy would be fully aware of Jerry's real work. Inside the State Department, a separate personnel office handles CIA paperwork and travel arrangements. The dozens of various forms in each file bear special indicators which ensure segregation. The CIA has never been as successful in putting officers in deep cover as the Russian GRU and KGB. Deep cover requires patience, and Americans are not patient. After a couple of years in one place, they begin to demand promotions, reassignments. No one wants to be a career private or even a career captain. They want to be in the mainstream, to advance up the chain of command. Recognizing this, when the agency finds someone with deep cover potential, it makes them contract or career agents. The connotation is ominous. Agents are not insiders. Agents are to be used and discarded when their usefulness is finished. Footnote: CIA staff officers are called case officers, and their sources or spies are called agents. This is the opposite of the FBI, where agents are the inside officers. End footnote. The agency has attempted to cope with this disability in many ways over the years, initiating and dropping one deep cover program after the other. The latest strategy is a parallel recruitment and training program. Young officer candidates are kept outside the headquarters building and away from the historic training and processing centers in the Commerce Building on Glebe Road in Arlington, Virginia, and the farm at Camp Perry. Footnote: formerly, the Commerce Building was the Blue Building, across the street from the present Commerce Building. CIA shuttle buses and limousines make hourly runs between all principal CIA buildings in the Washington area. End footnote. Some of these deep cover officers will take State Department Foreign Service Institute courses in Washington, and then go to the field as embassy, economic, or consular officers. Others will be businessmen, professors, students, or tourists, but they will still be conspicuously CIA to all who work with or near them in the embassies, in Washington, or in the local communities overseas. Few experienced CIA case officers will ever be enthusiastic about acting as an agent in a dangerous situation. They know too well how agents are sometimes abused by the CIA. For example, one extremely valuable Vietnamese agent had for years reported accurately on the Communist High Command. He became so famous inside the agency that he was discussed openly at headquarters and in Saigon, even at social functions in front of non-agency Americans and foreigners. At headquarters, he was commonly cited by lecturers in the Vietnam Orientation Seminar, attended by a wide variety of people outside the DDO. This insecure, unprofessional conduct was a clear threat to the agent's life, as well as to his viability as a reporting asset. The case officer tried to deal with it through the chief of station, but the COS refused to take any action, claiming that an effort to quiet the gossip would only provoke more. At the same time, in the COS's office, there was another top-secret operation which was handled much differently. A friend warned me to quit asking about it lest I be ordered out of the country by the COS. Eventually, I learned about it from an officer who worked with me up country. On a previous tour, my friend had helped install bugs in the South Vietnamese presidential palace. Footnote: the CIA had given Tu presents of TV sets and furniture which were bugged. End footnote. The CIA was eavesdropping on President Tu's private conversations. Security of the two operations differed as night from day. Precisely because exposure of the audio operation against Tu would be sensational news, embarrassing to the United States president, and possibly fatal to the COS's career. The agent, on the other hand, though he was providing incomparable intelligence, was not a political entity. His exposure would be an inconvenience, but not a catastrophe, except to himself. The Kinshasa station offices on the second floor of the embassy had changed little since my last visit 6 years before. I found the deputy COS working at his desk waiting for me. He offered to lock up any notes I had, but declined to stop somewhere for a drink and a chat about Kinshasa. He would instead drive me to St. Martin's Villa. On the way to the car, he apologized for the problem at the airport, adding, "The bastards are bloody difficult." "Why didn't you get the proper customs clearances," I asked, "and meet me at the airport?" "St. Martin wanted to take care of it himself. Show him he knows the president, I guess." Had St. Martin set me up? It was a Machiavellian thought, but such events in defensive CIA territory were common enough. St. Martin's huge villa, 20 minutes from the embassy, had been used by Kinshasa station chiefs dating back to Larry Devlin, when he ran the Congo program in the early 60s. I had slept in its guest room several times over the years. The foyer, where Jimmy set my bag, was as large as the living room of most American homes. Beyond was a vast space with three separate clusters of furniture, rather like a hotel lobby. That was the living room. A wall of French windows opened onto the $40,000 swimming pool, which another COS had added at government expense in 1968. The right wing of the house included 4 or 5 bedrooms, each with its own bath. On the left were the dining room, kitchen, pantry, and servants' quarters. Altogether, there were 6 bathrooms, including the one in the additional servants' quarters in the yard. The villa was cooled by a dozen air conditioners mounted in the walls. The rent and utility bills for all this, I had heard, came to $40,000 a year, initially paid by the embassy, reimbursed by the CIA. In the CIA view, such luxurious accommodations were necessary to give the station chief sufficient presence in the community. I had often wondered if the U.S. taxpayer would agree. Did the American public visualize its cold warriors doing their work in the back alleys of the world? St. Martin hurried out to greet me. He was of medium height, slender, with graying hair. His eyes sparkled, but the stresses of case officering and the attendant cocktails, cigarettes, and long hours were reflected in the lines and shadows of his face. Jerking his head back toward the living room, he indicated that a meeting was in progress. I could see an African sitting on one of the sofas. St. Martin led me to the door of the hall and pointed to a bedroom. Would I please make myself at home and come out when I was refreshed? St. Martin's living room was a busy place. Station personnel dropped by to confer with him and chat with me. Africans and Europeans, obviously agents and developmental contacts, came and went, passing each other in the foyer or sitting at different points in the living room, while St. Martin hopped back and forth. Most who entered St. Martin's villa would be aware that he was CIA. This flagrant exposure of agents to each other and to other CIA station personnel scarcely shocked me. It was normal for most CIA stations. I was a little surprised to find, in the middle of the crowded living room, an untended, wide-open briefcase, I wasn't sure which CIA officer had left it there, with sensitive IA feature cables right on top. Separate offices, housing, social habits, and the custom of inheriting the house, car, and friends of one's predecessor make it rare that any CIA officer is known in the official community of the host country as anything other than Mr. CIA, or one of them. Most case officers accept this notoriety with a perverse pleasure. Many operate as though they wore invisible badges, proclaiming, "I'm CIA, talk to me." This cavalier approach to cover became the vogue under Alan Dulles, the gentleman agent of World War II, whose superficial operations in neutral Switzerland inclined him permanently to underestimate the realities and consequences of intelligence operations. Nothing pleased Dulles more than to be known to the world as the CIA director, and he was fond of holding regional meetings overseas, rather like sales conferences, with his station chiefs. While abroad, in insecure areas, he made a great show of turning up the volume on radios, or even taking conversations into the bathroom where a running shower could provide security against bugs. Footnote: modern technology now easily penetrates the sound of a running shower to record voices. End footnote. From these histrionics, it was logical to conclude that while Dulles was completely indifferent to his field officers' covers, He did not fancy being quoted in police or opposition reporting. Senior officers competed to emulate the style of the gentleman spy, and younger officers could not be expected to keep a separate discipline. In Kinshasa, in the late 1960s, the chief of station would hold large cocktail parties for Zairean liaison officials and members of the diplomatic community. He required every member of his CIA station to attend those parties, laughing at any who protested that their covers would be blown. Like most young officers who had learned by the book, I was rudely awakened to the operational realities of the field. My predecessor in one post had handled 5 clandestine agents. 3 of them communicated through post office boxes. To deliver a written report and pick up money, they would call the European receptionist at the embassy, who was neither cleared for CIA activities nor completely loyal to the Americans. She would in turn relay the messages, advising the chief of station something to the effect that, "Your friend from FATA called. He has a shipment of skins and needs 8,000 bananas." The CIA station secretary would then drive to the post office and service the appropriate box. She did this so regularly that the beggars on the steps of the post office, in an effort to be helpful, would call out as she parked the car, "No, mademoiselle, he did not come yet," or, "Oui, mademoiselle, it is ready." Once or twice a month, in this tiny fishbowl of a town, the case officer would meet each agent a block from the embassy in a safe house, which was covered as an embassy guest apartment. After parking in the lot behind, the case officer would take the back stairs to the 3rd floor, while the agents came up the front. 3 of the 5 agents were introduced to me in that apartment, 2 during the same morning. The 5th I met in the living room of the case officer's house. Later, I discovered that the servant in the apartment below the safe house was the brother of the servant in my predecessor's house. He knew exactly what was going on and could identify all the agents. So could the Greek couple that ran a little grocery store on the ground floor. As I made friends through sports and chess, I began to receive well-meant suggestions. "Monsieur David," my predecessor 4 generations before, "used to live in my cousin's house. He said it was very good for his activities." Or, "Monsieur Jacques used to pick up the Lebanese gentleman in the alley behind my store. It's a safe spot and no one can see, except from my balcony." Such conversations also occurred in my other posts, where other American embassy personnel and people in the official community had gossiped freely about their spooks. In Burundi, a succession of case officers had written numerous intelligence reports from information gathered by their agents, mostly about the Congolese rebels across Lake Tanganyika. These reports repeatedly described the activities of a submarine on the lake, mercenary piloted airplanes which flew from landing strips in the hills of Burundi, and large supplies of rifles buried near Remong. That all of these notions were ludicrous, entirely at odds with physical, logistical, and political possibilities, did not deter CIA headquarters. Africa Division blithely disseminated hundreds of these reports to the intelligence community. Over the years, I learned that the operational standards I had found in my first assignments, low as they were fairly typical of most CIA stations. Jet lag brought me awake the next morning, just as light was coming in through the window. I showered and dressed quickly and went outside. It was nearly 7 a.m. The sky was heavy with clouds. Outside, away from the air conditioners, I could hear Kinshasa's morning sounds. People calling out, a car, a truck, some yellow and black weaver birds quarreling in a palm over the back wall. In the driveway, a uniformed African, doubtless St. Martin's chauffeur, was polishing a Mercedes 220. He grunted when I addressed him, but didn't seem to speak any language I knew. I wondered how St. Martin communicated with him. The Mercedes was sleek and new. Nearly all case officers in the field are authorized QP, or quasi-personal, cars, which are paid for by the agency. The justification is that an automobile is as essential to a spy handler as it is to a field salesman stateside. The argument loses some force when officers insist, as they often do, on having a Mercedes or Audi rather than a less conspicuous Volkswagen or Renault. Back inside, I found St. Martin drinking coffee in his bathrobe. "John," he said, "I've got to meet Colonel Mwamba for breakfast. Maybe you'd better go on to the office and wait for me. Take my car. Tell the driver, American Embassy. He paused and poked at an empty coffee cup. Then he pushed at a buzzer on the wall. Where is that damn boy? To St. Martin, I was an intruder, a representative from headquarters. He would keep my leash as tight as possible. Thus, I was not surprised when he showed up about 11 and gave one of his American case officers elaborate instructions on exactly where to take me, which car to use, whom we should talk to, and when to come back. I was in Kinshasa. I was in a difficult position, having no control over my schedule, my transportation, and my lodging. On the ground here, St. Martin was God. While it would never do for me to return to headquarters with only a superficial understanding of the FNLA, it was equally important to maintain the amenities. In any contest, St. Martin would win. Colby, Nelson, and Potts were sure to support their station chief. The FNLA headquarters occupied a block-sized compound not far from the embassy. It was surrounded by a high, bare brick wall. In front of a sheet-iron gate stood a solitary guard in a shapeless uniform. He held an old-looking FAL automatic rifle. Only after considerable name-dropping were we permitted inside. The inner compound was crowded with small brick buildings, their screenless wooden doors and windows unpainted and in many cases splintered and broken. Between the buildings ran narrow dirt drives and walkways. The compound, I guessed, had once been used by a small trucking company or perhaps a produce wholesaler. Dozens of people bustled from building to building, some wearing the gray-green uniforms of war, others in civvies and barefoot. For every soldier, there seemed to be several women and children. The sultry air carried the smell of cassava root and open sewage. A truck laden with people growled slowly through the gate, followed by a jeep filled with soldiers. The FNLA was rooted in the Congo tribe. Once the greatest tribe of the West African flank, when the Congo was splintered in the 19th century partitioning of Africa, the Congo gave its name to the Belgian Congo, the French Congo, and the mighty Congo River. Portuguese slave traders conquered the tribe, and hundreds of thousands of its sons and daughters were part of the flow of slaves to Europe, Brazil, and North America. Despite subjugation by the Portuguese, the Bakongo migrated freely across the superimposed colonial borders, following economic opportunities and fleeing oppression. In 1878, the Baptist Missionary Society, BMS, of London, was received in São Salvador, the historic capital of the Congo nation, by the Congo king, Dom Pedro V. 30 years later, a BMS interpreter, Miguel Nicasa, became the father of the modern Congo liberation movement. He was followed by other mission-educated Congo activists who struggled to gain control of the Congo chieftainship, only to be thwarted as the Portuguese succeeded in maintaining a succession of puppets on the traditional throne. By 1942, however, the activists had settled in the Belgian Congo under the leadership of Miguel Nicasa's son, Manuel Barros Nicasa. This exile group, first called the Matadi and Leopoldville groups, evolved into the UPA, União dos Populacos de Angola, in 1958, and became the FNLA in 1961. With the departure of the Belgian colonialists from Zaire in 1960, and the ascendancy of a government friendly to the Angolan rebels, the FNLA at last had a secure base of operations. In March 1961, years of careful planning culminated in the massive invasion across the Zairean border. The violence of this revolt appalled even FNLA leaders in Kinshasa, who had underestimated the repressed hatred and frustration of the Congo tribesmen. Although the revolt was partially checked by the brutal reaction of the Portuguese army, guerrilla fighting continued in northern Angola until 1974, when Portugal lost its will to keep its African colonies. Footnote. Markham, The Angolan Revolution, Volume 1. End footnote. Now, 15 months later, I commented to my escort officer that all the faces we saw in the FNLA compound in Kinshasa were somber. Yeah, well, he said, they've taken some losses in Angola, you know. Eventually, we found a well-fed young man named Timothée Makala, who was supposed to escort me to Ambrees the next day. McCalla, it seemed, had just returned from university studies in the United States and seemed nervous and flustered about our mission. Eventually, he admitted, with some embarrassment, that he had never in his life set foot in Angola. We had scarcely settled down to talk when my CIA escort officer attempted to drag me away, announcing, "Well, St. Martin said we should come directly back to the office." I took his arm and steered him to his car. "Listen, you go ahead. Tell St. Martin I'll be along before lunch. I want to browse around, get a feeling for these people." "I'd better stick with you. St. Martin said..." "You just go on." He started the motor, then cut it, attempting to get out again. "How will you get back to the embassy?" "I'd better stick around. This place isn't too safe, you know." He rolled his eyes around the compound. I held the door firmly shut. "I'll walk back to the embassy, or catch a cab, or maybe one of these nice people will take me to lunch. I've got a job to do and not much time to do it. Please, just go back to the office. Tell St. Martin everything will be fine. At the latest, I will be at his house before 2 to meet Roberto." He started the motor again and drove briskly out the gate, with an "I'm going to tell my daddy" look on his face. I found Johnny Eduardo, the FNLA second-in-command, in an office trapped by a dozen people who were contending loudly for his attention. Seated behind a bare table, looking hot and uncomfortable, Eduardo acknowledged my arrival with a nod, but made no effort to rise. I was barely able to squeeze forward and shake his hand. There was no chance I could make myself heard over the din. We shrugged at each other, and I elbowed my way back out. Eduardo was reported to be less tolerant of the Americans even than Roberto, whose arrogance was notorious. No matter that we were bankrolling their war, Eduardo would continue to resent us. So much for the FNLA headquarters, I thought ruefully, feeling the noontime heat as I walked out of the compound. What would I find at the FNLA front, north of Luanda? We were gambling $14 million that the FNLA fighting organization would be more impressive than its Kinshasa headquarters. Holden Roberto arrived at St. Martin's at 5. While we waited, Bubba Sanders scurried in, trailed by Raymond Childs. They had slipped into Kinshasa that morning to launch the FNLA propaganda effort, using Kinshasa newspapers. Filled with ideas, they already seemed to know their way around. They dropped names and spoke in half-sentences, as though they had worked in IA feature before, and I guess they had many times in other countries, with different players. Holden Roberto was trailed by 4 aides and staffers. We rose to meet them. Taller than the others, and wearing an exquisitely tailored Zairean bush jacket, Roberto was a dominant but rebarbative figure. His mouth turned slightly down in an expression of permanent disapproval. His negative impact was compounded by small, darkly tinted glasses, which he never took off. I could sense no warmth, although he addressed me politely enough. Bubba and Ray would have some difficulty producing a sympathetic propaganda photo. Born in San Salvador, Angola, on January 12, 1923, Roberto was named after a missionary who baptized him Holden Carson Graham. His mother was the eldest child of the revolutionary patriarch, Miguel Nicasa, and his father worked for the Baptist mission. In 1925, he was taken to Kinshasa, where he attended the Baptist mission school until graduation in 1940. In 1940 to 1941, he attended school in San Salvador to discover his Angolan roots. Thereafter, he worked for 8 years as an accountant for the Belgian colonial administration, and played soccer on local clubs where he established lasting friendships with future Congolese politicians. During a visit to Angola in 1951, he witnessed the brutalization of an old man by a callous Portuguese chef de posto and was shocked into political activism. In 1958, he was elected to represent the UPA at the All-African People's Conference in Accra, Ghana. Since blacks in the Belgian and Portuguese colonies could not obtain international travel papers, he was obliged to make his way clandestinely via the French Congo, the Cameroons, and Nigeria. It was worth the trouble. In Accra, Roberto met the cream of the African Revolution: Patrice Lumumba, Kenneth Kaunda, Tom Mboya, Franz Fanon, and many others. He was well launched. He rejected Marxist advances, but did espouse Maoist lines, writing friends that, without bloodshed, revolution is impossible. Before returning home, he obtained a Guinean passport and visited the United Nations General Assembly in New York, where he managed to foment a debate about Angola. He also visited Tunisia, where he gained the sympathy of President Habib Bourguiba. Back in Kinshasa in 1959, he established control of Bakongo revolutionary activities and took credit for the March 1961 offensive in Angola. Thereafter, he formed the Exile Revolutionary Government of Angola, GRAE, drawing in the Ovimbundu activist Jonas Savimbi as his foreign minister. His alliance with the Zairians held fast, transcending several upheavals and changes of government. Roberto's relationship with the ultimate Zairian strongman, Joseph Désiré Mobutu, was sealed when he dropped his Mukongo wife and married Mobutu's sister-in-law. Footnote: Mobutu later changed his name to Mobutu Sese Seko. End footnote. Roberto had continuously resisted a standing MPLA petition for a union of all Angolan liberation movements. Agostinho Neto had even followed Roberto to the United States in 1963, calling for a meeting with him and for a sympathetic hearing from the American establishment. Neto was rebuffed on both accounts. The Americans would not hear Neto out, since he was tainted with the Marxist brush. Roberto ducked him, allegedly fearing that the better organized MPLA leaders threatened his dominance. Perhaps also, Roberto was wise enough to know that competition between his conservative movement and the ominously Marxist MPLA would gain him sympathy in the United States. To guarantee the breach between the two movements, Roberto's forces repeatedly captured MPLA activists in northern Angola and transported them to its base at Kinkuza, Zaire, and killed them. In fact, Roberto was only conservative insofar as the word applies to East-West competition. Apart from ideological trappings, he and Neto preached the same things for Angola: national independence, democratic government, agrarian reform, economic development, Pan-African unity, and the total destruction of colonial culture. Footnote: see Markham, The Angolan Revolution. End footnote. And Roberto and his FNLA fighters were the more violent. At any rate, in Kinshasa, Roberto was our man. St. Martin scurried about serving drinks after arranging the seating so that he and Roberto were on the couch together. I was placed across the diameter of a pretty large circle, virtually out of the proceedings. Occasionally, St. Martin moved a hand in my direction, and Roberto glanced at me. God knows what yarn St. Martin was spinning. "Monsieur le President," I interrupted, rising, "you will be traveling with me tomorrow." I walked over and sat on the edge of the coffee table in front of Roberto. "No, I will meet you in Ambrise. First, you will go to Carmona to meet my command there." "Thank you. In Ambrise, we will have an opportunity to discuss my mission. Will you permit me to take photographs to show our experts in Washington what the terrain and weapons and FNLA fighters look like?" "Of course, of course." "Good. Now, I understand that you and Monsieur St. Martin have a lot of other matters to discuss, and also you will want to hear the proposals of my colleagues, Monsieur Bubba and Monsieur Raymond, who have come from Washington. Please excuse me." If I accomplished anything on this trip, it would begin tomorrow in Ambrise.